access to dollar contributions on the part of individuals so disposed. I'll be very frank with you, I remain today as strong an advocate of the dollar checkoff as I was in 1977. 17 states have some such system, either checkoff or check-on system. Oregon is the sole state of these 17 to have repealed that particular legislation. I think incorrectly was perceived as a political football, and in a statement that I wrote, I said the checkoff in Oregon was hardly that. It was rather intended to democratize sources of campaign finance by providing citizens with an equal opportunity to participate in financing elections, to remind candidates of their obligation was equally to the many members of the electorate rather than a few big givers, to revitalize Oregon's parties at the state and county levels through equal division of checkoff monies to the state and county organizations, and to revitalize the ties between candidates and parties resulting from organizational contributions of checkoff funds. I find no argument 8 years later with the original intent of the checkoff system. And if the political realities of 1985 suggest that checkoffs can't make their way through the legislative process, I'm very much in favor of the check-on system, where the individuals would indicate which political party he or she might want to support. Thank you.
Any questions, Jim? Thank you.
Thank you.
Nellie Fox?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and happy birthday, Senator Simmons.
Thank you.
We have always been supportive of the concept of public financing for campaigns. We deplore the high cost of campaigns as it has evolved. We think it's just pretty horrendous that you folks have to spend the kind of money that you do to run for elective office. And we see the check off first and then now the check on as a system of helping to address that problem. We wish that we as a political pack could go out of business and that we wouldn't have to be concentrating so much of our time and effort in raising money to give to our endorsed candidate. So we see this as a step in that direction, respecting the financial problems that face our state. That's why we agreed to change to the check-on as opposed to the check-off system that we had before. Some interesting facts in the years that we did have the check-off, by time it shouldn't really become a political issue because in the third year of the process there was just about $1,000 difference in the amounts collected by either of the main principal political parties. So we see that this shouldn't be a political issue politicized by the parties. It should be something that be utilized by both sides.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Questions, Nellie?
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else care to testify on the dollar check-on bill?
Mr. Olson. I would have one question of the committee or perhaps anyone in the room. I don't see anywhere in the bill where this would inhibit a person from receiving a tax credit on the money they donated to that party. But I wonder how they would arrange that. Would they Xerox a copy of their tax, their form, or would they, I suppose that would be the way they do it, the fair?
I would imagine that would be the way to do
it. Okay, that answers that. I think that could be accomplished that way.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Thank you. Hearing is closed. We can be in work session.
I move so far.
Senator Roberts moves Senate Bill 879 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson?
My understanding is this has no impact on the general fund. These are monies that we
that's right.
We owe the taxpayer, and that's where the source of revenue is.
Right.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I was concerned with the interest accumulated in the account.
But after a brief discussion with Senator Roberts, I feel that it's probably a small amount and would probably help towards administration of the distribution.
Right.
So I would be supportive of leaving it in the general fund.
I also, Mr. Chairman, just assume from what legislative council has said that unless something were specified otherwise, the interest would accrue to the general fund. And that would be my understanding.
Further discussion? Blenis?
Monroe?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Simmons?
No.
Yee?
Aye.
Roberts?
Aye.
Mr. Chair?
Aye. Motion carried. Senator Olson, would you like to carry the bill?
No, sir.
No, sir. Senator Yee? No.
No, sir.
Roberts and Monroe.
I'll carry the bill, Mr. Chair.
Senator Roberts will carry it. Okay.
Senator.
Pardon me, Senator Monroe. All righty. Thank you. We'll open the hearing on HJR 6. For our sign-up sheet, we have Kathleen Buffay.
Maybe it is.
Mr. Chair, while she's coming up, I have a fiscal impact statement on this bill distributed.
I should tell him every step.
Kathleen, tell us all about it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Kathleen Buffay, Office of Legislative Counsel. HJR 6 represents a redrafting of the reapportionment provision in the Oregon Constitution. It is brought to you by the Law Improvement Committee, which responded to the latest set of case law on the latest reapportionment by realizing that the Oregon reapportionment, which in its day was quite advanced, no one else had gotten around to it, but it was 1952, and the United States Supreme Court has since become very much interested in the subject, and the Oregon provision no longer resembled what the courts would accept under the rule enunciated in Baker versus Carr, the so-called one-person, one-vote rule. In addition to that, each of the cases that has developed in Oregon and nationally has changed the rules even more than the original pronouncement. And the last two reapportionments that the legislature has undertaken were certainly not undertaken under the provisions of Section 6, Article 4 of the Oregon Constitution. And I've had some comments received during the time when you were undertaking reapportionment of how come you all were doing it that way when the statutes or the provision of the Constitution was so very different, and having to explain to people. So one of the things that Law Improvement Committee decided to do was to try to codify the latest set of court rules, only to find, incidentally, that there's a case currently before the United States Supreme Court that may add yet an additional development. So the Law Improvement Committee has indicated that there's always a possibility that somebody will come running in with another amendment, or that at least this will have to be interpreted somewhat differently. What they've done in the new Section 6, which replaces the old, is to set forth a procedure and say that following that procedure, the legislature shall reapportion in the manner provided and required by law. This means that as the court cases change, at least the legislative guidelines, you know what they are, but they are not set forth in the Constitution in quite the fashion that they are in the current version. The dates were somewhat pushed to give everyone along the line, and particularly the court in reviewing the various apportionments, more time, because one of the complaints in the court decision was that the court was not allowed enough time to review and to actually get a very extended hearing on the case. I think I can lead you through this because you've been through this. If I tried to lead you through what the Constitution now says, you would probably wonder what you were doing the last time around. But this time, requires a reapportionment to be made at the next legislative assembly following the federal decennial census. The number of legislators, senators, and representatives is fixed by law. The Constitution has told you that you can have any number up to what you have now, but no more. Legislative districts are set forth. A senatorial district consists of two representative districts. Senators who would be holdover senators are assigned to a district. That's to overcome an issue that came up in the last reapportionment. The ratio is the total population by the number of senators for Senate districts and the number of representatives for representative districts. The reapportionment date, the cutoff date is July 1st, same date as it is now. The legislature then prepares a reapportionment. It may be subjected to review by the Supreme Court. If a petition is filed by a legislator or by an elector, on or before August 1st, so your first date is July 1st, it must be done. Anybody who wants to appeal it has till August 1st to move on that. The court then has up to September 1st to make its determination, and that it's the determination generally that the reapportionment does comply with the law, and it then would dismiss the petition, and the reapportionment would become operative on September 1st. If the Supreme Court determines that the reapportionment does not comply, it is the reapportionment of the legislature is void, and the court is to specify with particularity where the departures have occurred from what the court believes to be the rules on that subject, and that opinion then is sent, in a sense, forwarded to the Secretary of State by September 15th. Secretary of State is to conduct a hearing on that order to take evidence, views, and argument, in other words, conduct a public hearing, and then cause a transcript to be made and then to file the corrected reapportionment with the court on November 1st. That is a later date now. You're running a little later than you're allowed to under the present statute. The Supreme Court then reviews the Secretary of State's reapportionment to assure its compliance with the law, and may further correct it if it considers correction necessary, and you then have a plan that would take effect on November 15th. If the legislature fails to make its reapportionment by July 1, the Secretary of State makes the reapportionment in accordance with the standards indicated earlier, conducts a hearing at which the public may submit opinions, causes a transcript to be made, and then files the reapportionment with the court by August 15th. So July 1st to August 15th is the period of time given the Secretary of State, and I believe that's longer than is currently allowed. An elector may petition for review by the 15th of September. The court must conduct its review and determine by October 15th whether the reapportionment is valid. If it is not, the court again points out with particularity what's wrong, sends it back to the Secretary of State to have it corrected in those particulars, and then to refile by December 1st, to then review it again by the 15th, and that reapportionment becomes operative on the 15th. The reapportionment of the legislature is treated as a law. It is not subject to initiative and referendum, but it would be subjected to the possibility of gubernatorial veto. And the senators, the holdover senators, one of the issues that you remember came up somewhat academically, is what would happen if a holdover senator were subjected to recall. Who would the recallers be, the voters from the original district or the voters from the newly assigned district, because the boundaries may very well have changed? This proposal covers that by saying it would be the voters of the newly assigned district and not the voters of the original district. Now, because the more time was pushed into this process, it was necessary to propose the amendment to the constitutional requirement that legislators be resident of the district from which they are elected for 1 year preceding the election. That was extended to say that would be true most of the time. However, if it was an election following a reapportionment, it would be from January 1st of that year of election rather than 1 year from the date of the election. So the residence requirement for that one thing in every 10 years would be shortened by a period of a couple of months in order to accommodate a greater period of time in the review and revision, if necessary, of the reapportionment. Wouldn't be necessary if everything went through fine the first time, because the reapportionment would take effect on September 1st. But if it has to be changed or altered or reviewed, then that buys that additional time. Now, that's basically not terribly different from what you all did the last time around. It's just very different from what's set forth in the Oregon Constitution.
Okay. Any questions?
Madam Chair, Kathleen, page 3, line 6. The word whence. In literature, I seem to recall it's from whence.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Simmons, you notice this is also the same document that brought you to the original spelling of the word preceding.
Well, you changed that.
I got that.
I wondered why you didn't change whence.
Because I didn't think of it, sir.
It would seem to me that from which would be certainly less archaic and more in line with our clear language goals of the legislature, whether it's worth going back for concurrence with the House, I'm not sure, but it certainly appears to me to be a grammatical error as well as an archaic type term.
Senator Simmons, Gail informed me earlier that Hardy Meyer had some proposed amendments to this.
Judge Lindy has amendments.
And Justice Lindy?
Yes.
And I don't know what they are, but one of them is sick today. So we will be holding it over. But I guess I would ask you, if we do not adopt those amendments, would you be willing to adopt this the way it is, with that word in there?
We've lived with it for, 100 years.
My only concern is that if we agree on what we have here, I would just as soon not send her back to the House just for one word change. I'm thinking of the cost.
Well, we did change the he right following it. And, I might ask Kathleen to look at her great big unabridged dictionary and see if whence is a term that does mean that, the district from which.
Okay, and when we hear the other proposed amendments, why don't you highlight that one?
Okay.
You would. Any other questions, Kathleen?
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Yee.
Kathleen, on page 2, line 31 to 33, it seems to give the Supreme Court a lot of authority to correct reapportionment. Does this seem to give the Supreme Court the authority to actually draw the line?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, I don't know that this alters the role that the courts have played in reapportionment since they entered what one of the judges characterized as the mathematical thicket. And so the ability of the court to alter. Generally, the courts have not redrawn the lines. What they've done is say pretty definitely they ought to be here, here, and here, and then referred them back to some administrative official and said, now do it that way. But I think you probably will find some occasions on which the courts actually have, I think a federal district court in Texas, actually did the reapportionment, actually drew the lines and handed it back to them and said, this is the way it's going to be.
So I guess we have to ask ourselves whether we want to give the court the authority to draw the line.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, I think that what has happened in this line of cases, because the courts have interpreted the apportionment issue as being such a basic constitutional one, they have taken that jurisdiction as part of their jurisdiction to protect constitutional rights of voters, kind of regardless of whether the legislative body gave it to them or not.
Okay. Thank you, Kathleen. Ray Phelps.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Ray Phelps from the Secretary of State's office. I'll be brief. The bill, as it comes to you, and Gross House Joint Resolution 6, is completely supported by our office. We like the bill. The bill has amendments in it that we asked the House to place in it. We believe the timeline is minimal. We believe that without this timeline, as it originally was drafted, the bill is virtually unworkable from the point of the Secretary of State. So the bill is as we'd like it.
Okay. Any questions, Ray? Thank you.
One other point, Mr. Chair, if I may, and that is simply that the timeline reflects my own personal experience with the process in 1981.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Anyone else care to testify on H.J.R. 6? No, we'll close the hearing. And we will not take action. We will grant Hardy Meyer and Justice Mindy an opportunity to comment. Our next bill on the agenda is House Bill 2065. And we have Ray Phelps signed up, right?
Mr. Chair, I have another fiscal impact on this bill.
Okay.
Not for the record.
Ray, tell us all about it.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I did not hear the bill number. Excuse me.
2065.
Okay.
Changes 1 for 90 to proposed law 1 for 120 electors.
Yes, sir.
Of a voting booth.
This is a matter that deals with the number of voting stations at a polling place. This particular law has a history with me. When I first started with the office, the ratio was 1 per 40. And I think the chairman may remember when he was a member of the House of Representatives, we came to the House Elections Committee and asked that it be changed to 125. And the negotiation then shifted to 20. So we agreed that 90 was a reasonable number because of the process by which persons come through the polling place to vote. However, actually, and in reality, the way the process works, 120 is a minimal situation where one voting station for 120 persons will expedite the process and not cause an undue delay. The reason we're coming to you with this amendment, and it's as a result of an interim committee from last session, is that there are several counties. One is Linn County, not in compliance with the 1 per 90. And it's very, and it doesn't mean thereby that we want to change it to raise the threshold so that they are in compliance necessarily. It's just difficult for us to justify the 1 per 90 other than the fact that it's the law, when in reality it can be demonstrated that 1 per 120 will work just as well and cause no undue delay for electors, and at the same time will not cause counties to incur expenses for purchasing these devices. And this is particularly true in counties not Multnomah County, because Multnomah County has a voting system that is practically limitless with its expandability, in as much as all you need is a pen and a ballot and you have the voting process. But in other counties where you have electronic voting, such as Marion County or the counties of all the other members of this committee who do not live in Multnomah County, it can be as much as $150 to $200 per voting station. So it does get to be an expensive proposition for some counties.
Ray, when did we change it from, was it 40 to 90?
Yes, sir. I think it was in 1979, if I'm not mistaken. 79 or 81 is my recollection.
I'm trying to remember when I voted in the basement of the Troutdale City Hall, and it was probably about 5:15, 5:30, right at the rush hour. And I was standing in line. I was about number 10 or 12 in line. And I don't know if that was before or after we changed the numbers.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that I don't know that that would have had much of a bearing on this, because if you were voting in a, how shall I say this, an election where a large turnout is anticipated, such as a primary or general election, and you're voting between, say, 5 and 8 o'clock that evening, you're probably going to stand in line regardless of how many voting stations there are, for the simple fact that our surveys that we ran in 1981 and we run them again in 1985 because of an interest from the federal level with respect to commonality of closing times, our data has held for 4 years that 40% of everyone who votes in any election in this state vote between 5 and 8 o'clock. So I would suspect that you're going to have that problem regardless of the ratio. What we're trying to do here is be reasonable and set what we believe is the ratio that will work in virtually all instances, and that would be every election held in the state. You're going to run the risk of peaking at 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. But this is a standard that I've used in other parts of the country, and I've had election officials use in the other parts of the country, and it works very well.
Okay. Any questions?
Chair, are you assuming that on the basis of 120 electors to one voting booth, if 60% turn out, that's 72 voters. If 40% of those vote between 5 and 8, that's 28 voters. And that's about 9 per hour, which gives them something like 7 minutes, 7.5 minutes per person per vote. And I think that's certainly adequate in number of time. In my own precinct, which has usually 80% turnout, and the people are somewhat older than the average and consequently a little bit slower, I don't think I've ever seen a lineup waiting for a voting booth of maybe more than one per booth. So it seems to me that 120 would be a reasonable figure. And it, my own county says they think it would cost them about $20,000, counting the machines and particularly the storage of them and the transportation and setup time and so forth.
As I said, when I had to wait in line, and there was 10 or 12 people ahead of me. I don't know if it was before we made the change from 40 to 90. That I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, I'd say you probably have a better feeling as to how you voted in 1984, what your experience was in 1984 at the primary general election, because that would be, the ratio was 90 at that time, and that was a pretty substantial turnout.
Well, I helped him open the door in the voting place, so I never had any problem. But
Multnomah County has kind of a limitless expandability, if that's the right way to say that, because they use a marked sense system, and you can be, that tends to allow a quicker throughput than the less mobile voting stations you have in the other counties in the state.
Not related to the number of voting booths, but is there any lighting requirements?
Only that it be adequate.
What's adequate?
Light enough.
Yeah, light enough. Okay. Light enough for some, but not light enough for
not
others.
Not too dark.
Not too dark. Okay. Any other questions? Any other questions on House Bill 2065?
Any other witnesses?
Anyone else signed up?
Okay. Would you like a motion?
No, I wouldn't. I have to confess to the committee. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2065. The reason I wouldn't like a motion on these four bills we have before us is because on the House side, they have difficulty getting some of their bills out of committee. Hopefully, we can send these bills out the way they are. However, if worse comes to worse, we may want to amend something else in these bills and send them over. And to give you an example, I understand that on one bill over there, and I don't know which, vote by mail, what was that in?
They had voter registration.
Also. Voter registration, they had four minority reports. So they do have a little problem over there, and we might be able to help them with their problem, or out of their problems. Okay? So we'll open up the hearing on House Bill 2210. Where's the sign up? Ray, stay right where you're at.
Oh, that's fabulous.
This is on. We're good people.
Tell us all about House Bill 2210.
2210, Ray Fels from the Secretary of State's office. House Bill 2210, Mr. Chairman, is an attempt on our part to try to maintain our voter registration records with respect to the registrations of persons in the military. The processes for persons in the military to receive registration credential and to receive an absentee ballot have been improved and upgraded over the last half a dozen years, so that now, according to federal law and state election law, a person's request for an absentee ballot, as well as the signed statement returned on the absentee ballot itself, serves as a registration and an authentication of that process. However, because of the statute dealing with retention of voter registration records indefinitely for persons as members of the military, we wind up in a situation where we are keeping those records indefinitely when those records, in many cases, should be removed because the person is, one, no longer a member of the military, or their status has changed. And what we'd like to do is have the ability, based upon the information that we would receive after during a four-year period of voting inactivity, so that at line 12 and 13, if a person who is indicated as being in the military hasn't voted at all for 4 years, which is twice as long as for any other elector in the state, and would cycle through at least one